And here we come to episode 15 of All Movie Talk. And today's show is going to be just jam-packed. So let's get into it. We're going to start you off with the conclusion of the Best Of segment. We'll look at each year in the current decade, the 2000s. We'll have a trivia question from Sam that will almost certainly stump me because that's what always happens and I'm getting really sick of it. But anyway, I'm sure you guys like seeing me get humiliated. We're going to have an industry trend segment where Sam will tell us all about the history of sound in the movies, which is particularly important for two guys who talk about movies. We're also going to have a top six about mysteries where the mystery is not that important. Some good filmed mysteries. And also, to close things up, another installment in the Film Buffs Dictionary, where we're going to talk about crane and handheld shots, different ways of moving the camera around. I'm Stephen Keller. Yep, Sam, are you there? Did we lose you? Sam?
Yeah, I was there, but I was saying my name as if I were in a silent movie. Didn't you see the card?
Oh, no, I've got, I must need to adjust my brightness.
It is time now for the exciting conclusion to the Best of Octology, where we go through film history year by year, citing some of the great movies and talking about my favorite. We do this to give you a broad overview of film history and also some suggestions of movies to watch. And hopefully, as this series progresses, you're coming to understand something Stephen and I both believe in, and that's that there shouldn't be this dichotomy between critics' movies and popular movies. There are only good movies and bad movies. And if you look back at some of the movies we talk about on this show, hopefully you'll get a sense that we like a wide variety of movies. 2 weeks ago, I picked Amadeus as my favorite movie of 1984, and in 1985 it picked Back to the Future. So I think one of the many goals we have for this podcast is to encourage fans of blockbusters to try out some of these so-called critics' movies, and for scholars of art in film to appreciate the value of a well-made crowd-pleaser. Since the 1990s, we're starting to see a few different things happening, and time will tell what the long-running ramifications are. We're starting to see true independent film getting squeezed a bit. The increase in so-called indie studio arms not only encroaches a bit on the territory, but inflates budgets to the point where they look more and more like big studio films. The other thing we see is that computer-generated imagery is getting more and more realistic to the point where it's not enough just to have realistic CG. If you want to dazzle audiences, you actually have to have an original vision and use CG as a tool to bring that about. So I think that's definitely a good thing. Finally, another big thing is that Netflix hits it big. Netflix, of course, is a company that lets you rent DVDs by mail for a subscription fee, and nobody thinks the idea would work, you know, because people were thinking, okay, online downloading is the next step in the future of movie renting, and it probably still is, but Netflix really takes off in the interim, and while that may not have a huge impact on the types of movies that get made, it certainly has a huge impact on what people are watching. Because of the size of Netflix's inventory and its ratings and recommendation system, people are actually renting a broader range of movies. With the old rental store model, everybody just gets glued to the new release shelf, but with Netflix, you are better able to discover a lot of good but lesser-known movies, and so they're being discovered and seen by viewers.
All right, so let's go ahead and get started by, I guess, breaking down the movies by year. What do we have in 2000?
Okay, the Best Picture went to Gladiator.
Boo!
Maybe I was premature in saying CG was getting more realistic. Besides bad effects, Gladiator is a pretty stodgy, uninspired movie. If you think about it like this, go watch Spartacus and see how much better this kind of movie can be. Better choices this year: Requiem for a Dream, Amores Perros, Traffic, High Fidelity, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Almost Famous, and In the Mood for Love. My pick is Memento, an ingeniously twisted psychological mystery from director Chris Nolan. We talked about him in our pilot episode of this podcast, so if you missed it, you should go back and check it out. But he's fantastic at infusing thrillers with a compelling psychological component, and Memento is his best movie so far.
I like Memento a lot. For me, it's a close call between Almost Famous and Crouching Tiger. I love, love Almost Famous, and as on a personal level, it's probably my favorite of the year, but for the best film, I think Crouching Tiger is probably the best thing of the year. Just it's such a wonderful spectacle, and really, really, I think, sort of defines the wire fu sort of genre. Brings it in a way that's approachable and stylistic for the West. The first time I saw it, I was just so amazed by the stuff I was seeing, and I still look back at that as a fond movie-going experience.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more, and definitely one of my fond movie-going experiences, too. I think, you know, I might have picked that one at another time, too, for the best of that year. It's close. For 2001, the best picture was A Beautiful Mind. Again, a weak choice by the Academy. Not quite as bad of a choice, but it feels like such a rote retread of the Oscar movie formula, this feel-good biopic with a lot of artificially trumped-up dramatic highlights. Yeah, it's good while you're watching it, but I'm not sure that A Beautiful Mind really has the substance that keeps it with you after the credits roll for very long. And it's doubly frustrating because 2001 was a great year, at least for me. I loved a lot of movies from this year, like The Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Rings, Gosford Park, Amelie, Spirited Away, great animated movie from Japan there, Shrek, Black Hawk Down, and Mulholland Drive. I could easily have picked most of these in a less competitive year, but my favorite film of the 2000s so far is Moulin Rouge, a great musical and a truly original vision. It jumps from one great scene to another. The spectacular, spectacular number is a riot. Come What May is beautiful. The love song medley is so creative and the perfect way for two main characters to have a conversation with each other when mundane old words just aren't enough to carry their feelings. I also love the visual look to the film. It's actually a big-time special effects movie, but it doesn't look like it, because by and large the effects don't call attention to themselves, although certainly the cinematography does. I think at the time there are more effect shots in this than any other movie made, but you'd never guess that. Anyway, a powerful movie that hits a lot of different kinds of feelings.
Yeah, I love Moulin Rouge too. It's probably my pick for that year, though like you said, it's a very strong year. One thing worth mentioning is I don't think Moulin Rouge plays half as well on the small screen as it did on the big screen. It's a great DVD that's out, and it looks wonderful, but it's just, it's missing a little something when you see it in the big screen. You can really get lost in the spectacle, and I think it's sort of a shame. The movie became very popular on video, but didn't do that well in the theater. I think it's a shame that probably a lot of its fans haven't had the chance yet to see it in the theater.
You know what's funny? I agree with you. I think this was better on the big screen, although I certainly love it on the small screen. But, you know, I wonder if actually the smaller screen was a better way for a lot of people to see this, because on the big screen, it's a very overwhelming vision. And it's so, especially in the first 20 minutes, which are just very madcap, it's kind of like a visual overture. And it's just so madcap and crazy and kind of overwhelming in the theater. And if you're on its wavelength, then that's a great thing, and if you're not, you'd probably be a little put off by it. So I think a lot of people may have discovered it on DVD when it was a little more of a controllable vision.
Yeah, interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, definitely. I remember being overwhelmed when I saw it in the theater. What about 2002?
The best picture went to Chicago. I loved Chicago as a whole, but I hated the editing. It's like director Rob Marshall saw Moulin Rouge with all its artful quick cuts and decided he could get the same effect if he just took a pair of scissors and cut as much as he possibly could. It actually ruins a couple of otherwise great dance sequences because we just have no ability whatsoever to follow and appreciate the choreography. Otherwise, I like the movie.
That's interesting because Moulin Rouge, which you said is a great musical, is even more frenetic, and it's also very heavily edited. But Moulin Rouge works because it's not a stage musical. The big dance numbers were designed with the editing in mind, I think.
Right.
And where Chicago is just makes no sense to shoot the movie the way it was.
Right. But 2002 was a pretty dry year for movies in general, I think, and an unusual percentage of the Oscar contenders were disappointing and crumpled under the weight of their own self-importance. I'm thinking specifically of The Hours here. Others were good or even great, but lacked lasting emotional resonance, like The Quiet American adaptation, Frida, and The Gangs of New York. But this was the year of Far From Heaven, Minority Report, and The Pianist, and even the weakest of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, The Two Towers, ranks high in this off year. My two finalists here are City of God and Hero. And I should probably pick City of God, but I'm not, because I think Hero is probably the most beautiful movie I've ever seen. Wall-to-wall, beautiful colors, reflections, movements. It's a martial arts film starring Jet Li, but you know, the fight scenes remind me more of dancing than anything Bruce Lee ever choreographed, for example. When I think back on my favorite scenes, I don't even remember the physical contact of fists and feet and swords and whatever. I remember bright autumn leaves swirling around and encompassing the women. I remember two men skipping across a perfectly still lake, just lightly skimming the surface here and there. I remember billowing fabrics and wide expanses of sand and torrents of arrows arcing through the air. It's just so gorgeous, and it's not just beauty either, but there's a real kinetic energy behind it all, so it works on both an aesthetic and a visceral level.
Yeah, I agree with that. I like Hero a lot, too, but I also agree it was a weak year, which is why I'm completely and totally cheating, and I'm going to pick as my pick for 2002 season one of a television show called The Wire, which I know it's a cheat, but you can get the entire season on DVD, and it's a self-contained story. There's some stuff, obviously the show continues, there's some stuff that isn't resolved until a little later, but when I first saw it, it was up in the air as to whether or not there was going to be a season two, and I remember thinking, gosh, how are they going to do it? The show's over, everything is done with. It's a show about police and drug dealers in West Baltimore and the way that they interact, and it's created by a guy who was a former Baltimore crime reporter, as well as a man who was a Baltimore homicide detective for 20 years, and it has a very, very insightful way of looking at the way that the war on drugs interacts with the communities that are affected by drug dealers and open-air drug markets, and has a real insightful way of looking at the people who sell drugs and how they end up in that and how it affects them and how they're not maybe just pure evil monsters and how maybe some of them are. And it has a very streetwise feel to it, and I think it's pretty much the greatest show ever made. If you see the first season, I think it actually works basically as a 13-hour movie, well worth checking out.
Okay, well, next up on All Movie Talk, and also a little bit about TV.
It's really just a 13-hour movie. That's uh-huh. The real thing.
Uh-huh. Well, we come to 2003, and the best picture went to The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King. Conventional wisdom is that the Academy waited until the concluding entry in the trilogy and awarded that one on behalf of the whole thing. Other great movies, Lost in Translation, In America, Mystic River, Finding Nemo, Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, Kill Bill Volume 1, The Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, and a favorite of mine, Secondhand Lions, which we talked about way back in Episode 3. I think Lost in Translation and Master and Commander are two of my absolute favorites from this year, but I must ratify the Academy's decision. With the Lord of the Rings trilogy, Peter Jackson has really done the impossible. I don't think anybody really thought a good movie could be made from Tolkien, and he made three great movies, gorgeous to look at, impressively detailed, inspiring, and exciting, and such a relief from all the big effects movies that are so paper-thin on plot and character development.
See, I'm of the mind that if you're going to award The Lord of the Rings as a trilogy, I'm okay with it being here, but I think Lost in Translation is a much stronger film than Return of the King by itself. It's kind of hard to deal with, because you can't really take Lord of the Rings movies by themselves. If I have to pick, actually, a Lord of the Rings movie stand on its own, my pick isn't Return of the King, but the extended cut of Fellowship of the Ring, which I just think is a glorious film, and I think the other two are actually significantly weaker, though still great. Lost in Translation, I've mentioned it a couple times before, I love it. Great movie with wonderful characters. The sort of movie that really should have got a little more praise than it did.
Yeah.
What about 2004?
Well, the best picture went to Million Dollar Baby, solidifying an amazing career high for Clint Eastwood. It's unusual for directors not to lose their edge as they get older, but at 70-plus, Eastwood is still doing the best work of his career. It's amazing. Other choices, The Aviator, Hotel Rwanda, Sideways, Collateral, Before Sunset, Kill Bill Volume 2, Maria Full of Grace, and Downfall. Also a number of movies I have a particular fondness for that just make me smile when I think of them. The Notebook, Finding Neverland, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and The Incredibles. Until I sat down to plan this segment, I thought my favorite 2004 film was Maria Full of Grace. It's a wonderfully effective film that subtly builds an intriguing atmosphere, much like Lost in Translation, speaking of that. But this is about a Colombian woman who is serving as a drug mule when money gets tight and her family needs feeding. It's not really a drug movie. It's a very character-oriented movie about this one woman. But I think I have to defer to either The Incredibles or Eternal Sunshine, actually. And I'm going to go with Eternal Sunshine, but both are in different ways relentlessly imaginative and creative and really capture a fun kind of spirit that makes for great and lasting entertainment.
Yeah, and then The Incredibles is going to be the best superhero movie of all time until the following year when it's beaten. But I'd like to go ahead and pull an Academy here and award Kill Bill the best of the year and just go ahead and combine part one from the previous year, because it's really one long movie. I think Kill Bill 2 is a little weaker than Kill Bill 1, but when you put them together, you have one great, great movie that covers a lot of genres, and it's a real interesting movie from Tarantino. I think we all have this idea of a specific Tarantino-esque movie, but if you look at the two films he's done since Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown and Kill Bill, they're not really anything alike, and they're not really anything like his earlier movies. They just sort of all share really great dialogue writing, but definitely Kill Bill is a real masterpiece visually, and it's a lot of fun with also a great script.
Well, that brings us up to 2005, where some great movies made Munich, Good Night and Good Luck, Capote, Walk the Line, Hustle and Flow, Batman Begins, Sin City, Wallace and Gromit, The Curse of the Were-Rabbit, Cinderella Man, A History of Violence, The Constant Gardener, and the spectacular King Kong. So a lot of great movies. We're starting to get so recent, though, I think that we're not seeing these movies with the benefit of time. I think some of these will emerge and stand out, and others maybe will fade away, and time will tell how that will happen. The best picture that the Academy awarded was Crash, and my gosh, you'd think it was President Bush that won the Oscar for all the venom that started getting thrown around after the fact. I mean, people had pretty much decided Brokeback Mountain was a foregone conclusion and went wild and, frankly, vicious when it lost, to some people anyway.
Well, I think it got kind of tied up with the whole political...
That was definitely a lot of
it. So when movies get connected to current politics, it makes them, I think, hard to evaluate.
But, you know, I don't understand the reception of Crash anyway. The consensus seems to be that it's a great, brilliant film, but there's an unusual number of people who consider it the worst movie since Kangaroo Jack or some such nonsense. I just don't get it, because Crash is a great film. It's an episodic, Altman-esque story about a handful of characters in L.A. whose lives intersect in profound ways. Racism is the theme here, and how it pervades and affects our lives. It's a major accomplishment if a film has even one unforgettable moment. Crash has two or three, acted and edited to perfection, that make a profound appeal to the emotions and also to the intellect. It's smart about how racism isn't just about people who are enlightened or not, prejudiced or not. It argues that sometimes even conscientious, sensitive people can unwittingly be a part of the vicious cycle, how we're all responsible for it and all victims of it. The key to this movie, as opposed to something like Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, which also handles racism as an issue of complexity, is that Crash is a fable. And I think a lot of Crash's critics miss this. It doesn't matter if the way the lives of these characters intersect is unlikely or contrived or realistic or what. This is a fable. That's just the premise of this movie. It's a fable. The movie does this in order to illuminate important characteristics of human nature, and it does it in such a powerful way. If you haven't caught on yet, Crash is my pick for the best film of 2005.
Yeah, you know, you'll never see people complaining that, oh, the characters in Magnolia intersect in unrealistic ways. I don't get why Crash is held to some hyper-realistic standard. It doesn't seem fair. My pick, however, though, is not at all political. It's Sin City, a flick about fast cars, faster women, and big guns, directed by Robert Rodriguez, which surprised me because I don't really like Robert Rodriguez movies that much. I really didn't like Desperado or El Mariachi or any of those movies, or even I don't really like Spy Kids, which everyone else likes. But here we have an adaptation of some comic books that feel more like a comic book than any other movie. We have brilliant use of special effects. The entire thing is shot on a green screen, and all the sets are digital, pretty much. Brilliant use of black and white with some interspersed color, and just wonderful, hard-boiled dialogue. It's like you took some Raymond Chandler novels and put them through a blender and set it on super high and inject it with steroids, and you get this great movie where everyone is just talking in this wonderful, wonderful staccato rhythms. And I can't say enough about it. I love it. I love it. I love it. I don't understand why it wouldn't receive more of a critical reception. Maybe because it's gory and grisly and hard to watch at times. That might turn some people off, but if you got a stomach for some darker things, definitely, I think this is a movie that in 10 years we'll be looking back on and be like, wow, yeah, that was a really great, really a groundbreaking film.
So let me get this straight. In the year of Crash and Munich and Good Night and Good Luck and The Constant Gardener, you picked a comic book movie.
That's right.
Okay, well, just check in. 2006 has only just ended, still the beginning of January, and so I don't know that I can make a pick at this time because we haven't seen a lot of the movies that have come out in this year, but Stephen, have you seen any that might be contenders yet? Prairie Home Companion, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. It's really hard to say. I think 2006, the first part of the year, was kind of dry, not that inspiring, so I haven't obviously seen every movie that's come out in the winter, and some of them we still haven't got a chance to look at in wide release yet.
Yeah, I haven't really seen anything that I think will make the list yet. But that brings us to 2007, where the Academy made the amazingly insightful choice of The Red Giraffe Meets the Brown Hippopotamus. It's kind of not really an Academy movie, kind of like going back to Babe that they nominated. It's about talking animals, and it's just this wacky CGI animated feature. I think the Academy picked it because it's just so original. We haven't really had a lot of CGI animation about talking animals lately, and I think this was just really inspiring, and so they picked that. My favorite film of 2007, however, would have to be How the Dishes Got Done. I think we don't have enough movies about housework, and this one really gets to the heart of what it is to keep your personal space clean and orderly, and what that means, you know, to be human. I mean, that's a part of what humanity and our human psyche is all about, is cleaning the dishes. So I really like this movie.
I mean, certainly there are things to admire about it, but did we really need a 30-minute sequence shot from the perspective of one of the dishes in the sink with the water and the woman washing them?
I think so. I mean, it helps you identify with the things you're cleaning.
I thought the traffic scenes in Solaris were unnecessary. I mean, here we've got just dishes. It didn't work for me. My pick is going to have to be Lord of the Rings 4, Aragorn's Revenge, which I thought was a great movie and a good choice to introduce the science fiction elements with the time machine and all that and the laser guns. And laser guns versus wizards. And, I mean, what else could you ask for in a movie? That is probably the pinnacle of fantasy science fiction, plus the introduction of dragons. I always thought that The Lord of the Rings was missing dragons, and here you got lots of them fighting each other, and they're the guys in the supersonic jets fighting the dragons. I mean, that's awesome.
Pirate dragons, in fact. That was remarkable, yeah.
Yeah, it's not what you expected.
So I agree with you there. It's certainly... I thought the special effects, I don't know. I mean, the dragons were great and everything, but Aragorn himself, you know, of course, Viggo Mortensen did not agree to sign on to do a fourth movie for some reason, and so they used special effects to put in a stand-in there, and, I don't think it was really that convincing.
However, I thought the special effects they did with his robotic claw arm that could expand and contract and shoot lasers, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, but it's right out of Dr. Strangelove. Where's the originality?
That's true. So I guess we'll get to 2008 after we've seen some of the movies from that year.
Right, yeah. So at long last, this brings us to the end of our Best Of series. And
I know you're happy about that one.
I'm very happy about that. It's been a long time researching and recording all this. But the Oscars are around the corner, and we'll be talking about some of the great movies of 2006 during our Oscar coverage, so keep listening to the podcast.
And remember, if you missed some, you can always go to the website, allmovietalk.com. You can get old episodes, and you can find, you know, lists of all these great movies and what our picks were and that kind of stuff. So, I mean, it can be hard to sometimes get it all while you're just listening to it. So just, yeah, allmovietalk.com, and you can catch up on anything you might have missed.
Finder's Fee is a 2001 thriller co-starring some interesting actors such as James Earl Jones and Matthew Lillard and Robert Forster, among others. James Earl Jones in particular is just wonderful, but of course he's James Earl Jones. But the story's about a poker game and a winning lottery ticket and how one guy tries to con another guy out of it without his buddies catching on at the poker table. But I won't say any more than that. It's actually really good. Starts a little weak, maybe, but builds and becomes incredibly gripping with touches of humor along the way. One of the really neat things about how the whole movie is kind of like a poker game. It's a lot of fun to try to read the characters, especially James Earl Jones, and try to deduce what roles they're playing here. Again, the movie is called Finder's Fee. And this brings me to this week's trivia question, and that is to identify the person that wrote and directed this movie. It's one person, a writer-director, who wrote and directed this movie, Finder's Fee. Now, to make things a little easier, this is going to be a multiple-choice question. So, here are your four choices, Stephen. Choice A, Ty Pennington, the host of Extreme Makeover Home Edition and former host of Trading Spaces. B, Jeff Probst, the host of Survivor. C, Joe Rogan, the host of Fear Factor. And D, Ryan Seacrest, the host of American Idol. One of those people wrote and directed this movie.
Really?
Yep. So we'll find out who it is and if Steven can guess the correct answer at the end of the episode. Over the next segment, I'm going to try to recap the development of sound in the movies in lightning speed in our industry trend segment for this week. This is a huge topic, but I'm going to slim it down a bit by shying away from the technical details about how things work and simply focus on interesting landmark movies and developments. When we covered the subject of color in the movies back in episode 2, some of you may have been surprised to learn that color had been around almost since the beginning of film. In fact, the same is also true of sound. In 1888, Thomas Edison met up with a guy named Edward Muybridge, and Muybridge had previously worked with stop action photography, photographing a galloping horse, rigging things so the horse's hooves would trip the shutters on some 700 cameras, and the photographs would be mounted on glass plates and displayed on a device he created and called the zoopraxiscope, something like that, where the glass plates would be rotated in rapid succession and convey the illusion of movement. This was all before the development of film, even. Anyway, Edison was intrigued by Muybridge's work, and he bought some of his photographs and proposed that they work together on synchronizing sound recorded on a photograph with the moving images. Well, Muybridge thought, that'll never work, and his reason was that the phonograph wouldn't be loud enough for people to hear. So he opted out of this, but Edison was inspired by this zoopraxiscope thing and built on that idea and invented, along with William Dixon, sort of a debate on who gets the credit for this, but they invented the kinetoscope between 1888 and 1892, which is a box you could look into, and the device would take a strip of perforated film, slide it over light, and convey the illusion of motion. But Edison's goal all along actually was to get synchronized sound with the images. He invents the kinetophone around 1894, 1895, which didn't really have synchronized sound, although some sources do make this claim, but basically it was a kinetoscope with a phonograph built in, and one switch would turn on them both at the same time, so you could have music or some other kind of sound accompanying the moving images. And who knows what kind of further advancements Edison and his company might have made in this area if projection hadn't come around along this time. In 1896, Thomas Armat invented the vitascope, which would project moving images onto screens, and Edison decided to abandon his work with the kinetoscopes to finance and advance this vitascope thing. They didn't have sound, but right away he experimented with mechanically synchronizing sound recordings with the image. So the age of silent films begin, because whatever Edison is doing, it's not in a commercial marketable state yet, and the silent film era lasts until roughly 1926, although silent films continue to be made until 28 or 29 or so regularly. But it's a bit of a misnomer because silent films were never silent. Even as far back as 1895, at the first public commercial projection of movies, the picture was accompanied by live sound. Until about the teens, there would usually be just a single pianist improvising the music to play as the movie played for audiences. Then during the teens, the movie houses might have an organist instead of a pianist or even a full orchestra. And as for the music itself, you'd start to see cue sheets being distributed with the movies, and starting with Joseph Carl Breil's score for The Birth of a Nation in 1915, original scores would be composed and distributed with the movies. At the height of the silent era, movies employed actually more musicians than any other source of employment for musicians. Now, all during this time, attempts were made to come up with a viable way to have pre-recorded, synchronized sound. A bunch of inventions cropped up and died out for one reason or another. The synchroscope from around 1907, the vitaphone, the chronoscope, and all kinds of others that are really just names in history now. Edison resurrected his kinetophone idea and had it modified with a bunch of pulleys and stuff to try to sync up the audio with picture, but that didn't work well at all, and it actually got booed at a public demonstration. One thing that did briefly catch on was phonofilm, created by Lee DeForest in 1919, which records sound directly onto film as a series of parallel lines that could be translated back to sound at projection time. And he tries to bring the invention to Hollywood, but Hollywood strangely isn't interested, perhaps because the fidelity of the sound wasn't that great. And so DeForest goes off on his own to make short recordings of vaudeville acts and political speeches and ballet and that kind of thing, and exhibits them in his own theaters. He couldn't use the movie theaters, because at that time, movie theaters were owned by the Hollywood movie studios, which would only exhibit their own product. So he gets his own business going, and about 200 short films are made with this process. No features, I don't think, just short films, including a series of Follow the Bouncing Ball sing-along cartoons by Max and Dave Fleischer, who created Betty Boop later on. Interestingly, a lot of these phonofilm shorts still survive today. Anyway, the big reason we see so many inventions come and go is that there were two really big problems people kept getting hung up on. One, where do you record the sound information? You have the picture on film and the sound on a record or something, technologies that are really nothing alike, how do you tie them together cleanly? The second problem was in regulating the film speed. See, with silent films, projectors were hand-cranked. And even the best cameramen couldn't be perfect at regulating the film speed as they cranked the film, and projection rates were not very precise either, so this is why a lot of silent movies have action that seems faster, or maybe even a little slower sometimes, than real life. Well, if you synchronize your sound to your picture, and your picture speed isn't regulated, then that's going to distort the audio that you hear and be much more distracting than sped up or slowed down film, and so this is a real stumbling block for the introduction of sound to the movies as well. So, phonofilm is around, but it never really caught on with Hollywood. Instead, two other processes came about in roughly 1926. One was Vitaphone, developed by Bell and Western Electric and adopted by Warner Brothers. And this was the system that stored the sound information on 33 and a third RPM records, which itself is kind of interesting because at the time, the standard speed for phonograph records was 78 RPM, revolutions per minute. But this was problematic for the movies because they had such a short playing time. So the speed was reduced to 33 and a third, and that gave you about 11 minutes of sound for a record, which is about the length of one reel of film, so they fit together pretty nicely. The other weird thing about Vitaphone records is that the needle moves from the inside of the disc to the outside, definitely not what we're familiar with regular, you know, any LP kind of records we have today. Anyway, synchronization was achieved by the film projector having an extra gear that would interlock with the phonograph turntable, and there would be start marks on both the film and the record, and the projectionist would have to be careful to thread the film to the right spot and position the needle correctly before starting the projector. Very tedious process. But it worked, and in 1926, Warner Brothers marketed the first film with synchronized sound, which was called Don Juan, an adventure film starring John Barrymore. It was a silent film in the sense that there was no spoken dialogue, but music and sound effects were pre-recorded and synchronized to the film. The following year, Warner released The Jazz Singer, starring Al Jolson, which very famously was the first movie to have dialogue. Originally, it was actually supposed to be a silent movie with singing in it, and indeed much of the movie is silent, but the star Al Jolson ad-libs some dialogue, and so we enter the age of the talkies, so they called them. 1 year after that, Warner Brothers' Lights in New York becomes the first movie to have dialogue throughout the whole thing. There's no silent pieces as there was in The Jazz Singer. And also in 1928, Walt Disney releases Steamboat Willie, which wasn't actually the first cartoon with synchronized sound, but certainly was the first successful one. And more interestingly, it's the first film of any kind whatsoever to have a soundtrack completely created in post-production. Sound effects, music, dialogue, the works. Normally, sound was recorded on the set.
So they didn't record on the set for that cartoon?
They did not record it on the set for the cartoon.
No, oh really? Yeah. No on-location sound.
Right.
Oh, interesting.
Yep. So the other sound process to come about roughly the same time Vitaphone does is called Tri-Ergon, later marketed as Movietone by 20th Century Fox, and they started producing Movietone News, a series of newsreels, in 1928, and among these included the famous coverage of Charles Lindbergh's transatlantic flight and also the explosion of the Hindenburg. And in 1927, we see the release of F.W. Murnau's great film Sunrise, which was a silent film but used the Movietone process to store synchronized soundtrack of music and sound effects. Now, this process, Movietone, recorded sound information directly onto the film, kind of like the old phonofilm thing did. Obviously much more elegant than using phonograph records and film for playing the movies back, and this has become the first of a succession of sound-on-film systems that started to come out around this time. Vitaphone gets phased out, and it is the last sound-on-disc process to be used until digital theater sound, or DTS, current state-of-the-art sound, returning to using discs for the first time since the late 20s. So everything's a circle, I guess. Incidentally, the Vitaphone name is kept around long after the Vitaphone sound process is retired. So when you see like an old Looney Tune cartoon and it says Vitaphone Corporation on it, just be aware that they're not using the Vitaphone sound process. Now, there isn't a whole lot of technological advancement for a while after this. I mean, there's a couple different sound-on-film processes that come out, but the Great Depression hits, and not a lot of money is spent on research, but we do see sound used more and more creatively as filmmakers become comfortable working in the medium. A real landmark is the 1933 King Kong, where sound designer Murray Spivak became the first to manipulate sounds in a creative fashion, rather than just playing back what you recorded, he would create new sounds, animalistic roars and grunts and things by, for example, taking a lion's roar and slowing it down and lowering the pitch. The other thing he did was tweak the placement of the sound so that they would sort of sync up with the music in the film. The score was already completed when he started adding the sound effects. And the effect is very subtle, and of course, the movie is just loaded with all kinds of jungle sounds and roaring and everything going on around you for much of the running time. But these are all sort of flowing into the rhythm of the music, and so there's a subtle coordination there, and it makes things feel a little bit more fantastical. We also see during the 1930s the development of stereo sound. Stereo doesn't become commonplace for decades yet, but experiments are done with it in the early 30s. In 1931, a guy named Alan Blumline patents a process for recording stereophonic sound, and he continues to develop stereo sound over the next few years, believing that for sound to be realistic, it has to positionally follow the action on screen. But stereo sound is expensive, costing about twice as much as mono, and so although you do see stereo crop up here and there, mono remains the standard until the 1950s. In the meantime, though, we do see the release of Fantasia in 1940, which is the first multi-channel movie. Three channels for sound, one more to control the volume level. But after an initial roadshow tour of the movie, the soundtrack was remixed to mono for general release. It's not until the early 50s that stereo becomes commercially successful because Hollywood was looking for ways to compete with television, and so they invested a lot of money in improving the theater-going experience. So in 1952, we get Cinerama, which is sort of the IMAX of the 50s, and it had this huge curved screen, these three panels that curved around the audience, and it had six audio tracks. In 1953, we get CinemaScope, which is another competing widescreen process, not quite as dazzling, but it had four audio tracks. And very briefly, we see Warner Phonic, which was quickly put out of business by the Superior CinemaScope process, but it did produce the first general release stereo movie, which was the 3D movie House of Wax in 1953 with Vincent Price. In 1955, we see the Todd AO widescreen process that supports six audio channels, and so all of a sudden, a lot of processors are coming to light that support both widescreen and stereo sound, and these things very quickly become the industry standard.
Now, Sam, why is it the widescreen process that lets it support sound or better sound?
Not necessarily. I think it's just they were developing a new process to make everything better, and so they came up with a way to... It's because the sound is stored on the film, and if you're changing to support widescreen, you might as well redo the sound as well.
If you use an anamorphic lens, it changes the way that
right.
You actually... Yeah, I mean, I think it gives you room, doesn't it, for extra soundtracks on the film?
And definitely, I was noticing, in 35mm, it's much more difficult. Like, right off the bat, 70mm has these great sound systems, and 35 doesn't necessarily for a while. And so, actually, a lot of 35mm films were blown up to 70 in order to take advantage of the sound.
Interesting.
At this point, sound development coasts for a while. In 1965, we see the introduction of Dolby Noise Reduction, which improves the quality of movie soundtracks. This was first used extensively in Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange in 1971, and more big spectacle systems show up. In 1967, a prototype of IMAX is exhibited, and the first IMAX theater is built in 1971, and it had a new and improved six-channel audio system to go along with the larger picture. In 1974, we get Sensorround, which I like this one. It supported these super low sub-audible tones, and you could feel it more than you can hear it. You know, so you get these deep rumblings that vibrate in your chest. The Sensorround speakers didn't actually play any of the actual soundtrack. They only played these low tones for effect. Well, there were only four Sensorround movies ever made. The first was the disaster movie Earthquake, and there was also Roller Coaster and Battlestar Galactica, and easily the best of the four, Midway, about the World War II battle with Japan in the Pacific, all great choices for Sensorround, because when there was an earthquake or bombs exploding on aircraft carriers, you could really feel the impact. But as I say, there are only four made, and the reason is kind of funny. It turns out that the Sensorround was powerful enough to be causing structural damage to the theaters. Walls were cracking, and very famously, Mann's Chinese Theater in Hollywood, they strung up this safety net underneath the ceiling to catch pieces of falling plaster. the other thing was at multiplexes, there was just no way to keep the sound from bleeding into other theaters. So some people attending the opening of The Godfather Part 2 were experiencing these huge rumbling vibrations coming from Earthquake next door. So SenseAround fails. It becomes notorious, though, and studios want to try to come up with technologies that could do this sort of thing, have this effect, but just maybe not that extremely. So we get things like Sound 360 in the late 70s and Megasound in the early 80s and a bunch of other things that don't really catch on. And pretty much the rest of sound history from this point continues this rapid succession of just a new sound system one after another that maybe doesn't create, you know, it's not like having no sound and going to sound, or mono and going to stereo. It's just trying to improve on what we already have. Dolby Stereo debuts with A Star Is Born in 1978. Dolby's Baby Boom format debuts with Star Wars in 1977. The first use of the 5.1 format we think of today, where we have left, right, center, left surround, right surround, channels and a low frequency channel. This is in Apocalypse Now, and it's used Dolby's split surround format. Just real quick, a few others. In 1983, Return of the Jedi becomes the first movie to use the THX sound system. In 1987, RoboCop and Interspace are the first to use the Dolby SR cinema digital sound, debuts with Dick Tracy in 1990. Dolby Digital debuts with Batman Returns in 1992. DTS, which as I mentioned before is a return to storing sound on disc, debuts with Jurassic Park in 1993. SDDS, which is a 7.1 format, which exceeds every major earlier system in terms of number of channels, debuts with The Last Action Hero also in 1993. We're going to continue, I think, to see this sequence of improvements. This one has more fidelity and more. This one has more channels, whatever. But basically, at this point, we can have whatever sound we want in the movies, kind of like the way special effects have evolved to almost whatever we can imagine we can finally have some means of putting on the screen. But anyway, that pretty much takes care of the history of sound in movies. Next week, we're going to slow it down a little and talk about the impact of sound on film history. It was probably the biggest single thing, the advent of sound, that happened to change the art of movies and the way movies are made and the careers of the movie makers. It killed actually a lot of careers and made a lot of others. So we'll talk a little bit about that next week.
Who done it? It's a question that movies have been asking since almost they've been around. And I think we all love a good mystery, but what I love more than a good mystery is a good mystery where the mystery doesn't matter. If that doesn't make any sense to you, that's okay, because we're going to spell it out as we go on our top six list today, and that is mystery films where the actual resolution of the mystery isn't all that important to the movie. My number six pick is the movie Clue, a movie from 1985, directed by Jonathan Lynn, whose resolution is so unimportant that there are, in fact, three endings, all of which equally probable. When it was released into the theaters, you only got one of the three endings, and you had no way of knowing when you went to see it which ending you would get. It was a little joke perpetrated on the audience by the filmmakers, and it's clever. The movie itself is hilarious. It's a parody, more or less, of sort of drawing room mysteries where all these guests are gathered in a big manor house, and someone gets killed, and they have to figure out which one of them did it. And, of course, it turns out that you can go and pick any one of them and come up with a reasonable explanation, as was shown with the multiple endings. If you catch the flick on DVD or video, you do, in fact, get all three endings, and it's an interesting way to watch it.
Oh man, I forgot about Clue. That's definitely one of my favorite movies from growing up. It's great comedy. It would have made my list. Darn. I actually watched this in the theater back when it came out. I got the last ending, which I think the best one. So
yeah, I think everyone agrees that's the best.
We got the video. It's like, oh wow, there's more stuff here. That was unusual. Anyway, my number six and my number five are also mystery-themed comedies. Obviously, a spoof of the mystery genre is going to be primarily about the comedy rather than the mystery. It doesn't matter who did it as long as it's funny. So I restricted myself to two. My number six was made in 1976 and written by Neil Simon, and it's called Murder by Death. And this is a parody of drawing room mysteries. Basically, all these different famous detectives gather together in a house, and all these characters are thinly disguised versions of people like Sam Spade, Nick and Nora and Charles, Miss Marple, Hercule Poirot, and Charlie Chan, except they're Sam Diamond and Miss Marbles, and so on. Not all the gags work, but there's some clever writing here, and it's quite amusing.
Yeah, you know, I also picked another comedy for my fifth, and that's The Big Lebowski, the cult classic from 1998 by Joel and Ethan Coen. And it's a movie that's sort of a parody of the Raymond Chandler novels from the 40s that were made in a bunch of movies, including The Big Sleep, hence the title. And it's about a stoner who gets caught up in a complicated kidnapping plot that, you know, may or may not be occurring. And when you finally find out what happened to the girl, none of the characters at that point even really care because they've all gotten involved in their own things. The character played by Jeff Bridges, the dude, really just wants to get high, drink some White Russians, and play some bowling. But when some thugs mistake him for somebody else and destroy one of his prized rugs, he goes on a quest to get it back and ends up on a long mystery that doesn't ever really quite go anywhere except in a circle.
I think that a lot of the movie is about people who don't have a lot of ambition, so it makes sense that the movie doesn't have the ambition to pursue
right.
its mystery.
Though to be fair, right? it is a very complex plot that it does all kind of fit together, but none of the characters seem to care that much by the time it's over.
My number five is called A Shot in the Dark from 1964, the second Inspector Clouseau film. It's a bit different from the others, which tend to spoof crime flicks, heists, and that sort of thing. This one is a spoof of Agatha Christie's stories, however, where you have a big house full of suspects with all their own little intrigues going on, and the detective has to try to track down the killer. The secret to these movies is Clouseau is completely incompetent, but he doesn't know it. But he really knows how to go through the motions of looking competent in a way that's very obvious that he's not. But he unwittingly stumbles on the solution anyway. You know, and how in Hercule Poirot mysteries, Poirot gathers everybody together in the end and explains the mystery and unveils the killer. Well, in this scene in A Shot in the Dark, this parody of this when Clouseau does this, it is just some of the funniest stuff ever. Peter Sellers was a genius.
Yeah, he absolutely was, Sam. Anyway, my number four pick is much more serious. It's The Conversation from 1974, directed by the great Francis Ford Coppola, and stars Gene Hackman as a sound recording engineer who records some conversations. He's just out gathering some sample noise, and when he's piecing it together, cleaning it up, maybe he overhears some stuff that he shouldn't overhear, and suddenly there are people out to get him, or are they? It's a strange, subtle psychological movie that makes us question exactly what's going on, and by the end of the film, we think we know what's probably happened, but we're not sure. It does a very good job of ratcheting up the paranoia, but really, because we're never entirely clear what it is that he's captured, or maybe we think we know, but we don't really know who these shadowy people are. Of course, he spends a lot of the movie trying to figure out what he's captured. It doesn't end up mattering. What matters is the atmosphere, and the paranoia, and the way it gets inside the character's head.
Yeah, it's a great movie. If you've seen Brian De Palma's Blowout, this is where that idea came from, of gradually piecing together some piece of media and solving a mystery that way. My number four is L'Avventura, 1960 film by Michelangelo Antonioni. In English, the title means The Adventure, which is intended to be ironic, I'm sure. The setup is a bunch of rich people take a yacht out to a volcanic island in the Mediterranean, and one of them, a woman named Anna, disappears. And it's strange because there aren't that many places she could have gone. I mean, everybody's panic at first and searches all around for her. They call for help, and there's a more thorough search later, but nobody can figure out what happened to her. And this sounds like the setup for, you know, I don't know, a kidnapping plot or one of those murder mysteries where the gimmick is there's no body. But it's funny, the movie builds up this driving force for the characters, and they just gradually sort of forget about it. They go back to the mainland and keep searching for her there, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And then they wind up going up to some different cities ostensibly to keep up the search. But in their conversations with each other, they get less and less focused on it, and to the point where they wind up reminding each other, oh yeah, we're searching for Anna. But eventually we get the point. This movie isn't about Anna. It's about exposing the aimless, zombie-like lifestyles of the upper class in Italy at this time. They're idle, decadent, bored, and they grasp at pleasures whenever they happen to be on hand. But they don't have the will to be truly alive. They're dead inside. Jean Renoir did a similar thing with The Rules of the Game in 1939, although things actually happen in that movie. This one, the only thing that really happens is this woman's disappearance, and that is enough to stir the others to life, but only briefly.
One time, Sam, I wrote a video game based on the film L'Avventura.
I bet it was really exciting and a lot of things happened in it.
That's one way of putting it. Well, you know, it's interesting because along a very similar vein, my number three pick is Blow Up, another Michelangelo Antonioni film. I think it's funny we each got him so close to one another. And I actually think that it's this movie as much as The Conversation that De Palma ripped off for Blow Out. So note, Blow Up is not Blow Out, even though Blow Out is kind of a ripoff of Blow Up. Blow Up is a 1966 film about a photographer, and it's kind of similar to The Conversation. I think Coppola was definitely inspired by the Blow Up. But Blob is about a photographer in sort of swinging 60s London who photographs some people out in the park and realizes that, again, he may have accidentally captured a murder in one of his photographs as he's blowing them up. He realizes he sees some stuff that maybe he shouldn't have seen, and suddenly he's worried that his prints might disappear or what happens. But this, again, sounds like it should be the setup for a conventional mystery, but Antonioni, of course, goes sort of off the rails, and the movie becomes more and more aimless, and by the end of the movie, we still have no idea at all whether he's actually captured anything on film, and everything sort of literally fades away and stops becoming important. It's again, sort of an attack on aimless pleasure-seeking without purpose.
But, of course, the difference with Blow Up, besides that it is an actually entertaining movie, is that the main character is truly alive when he's absorbed in his work, and I think that's one of the things that is so compelling about the movie, is seeing him engaged in his craft. When he's photographing things, developing his film, all that stuff, he's determined and he's unwavering, and it's only when he's away from that activity that his life sort of gets aimless and he's kind of lost in life. I actually double-dipped with Antonioni. I picked it for number two, so I'll say a couple more words about that when we get there. But my number three is Gosford Park, directed by Robert Altman in 2001. This is an Altman-esque, of course, take on Agatha Christie. It's an upstairs-downstairs kind of a thing, a mystery set in England in 1932. A whole bunch of people gather at a country house for a weekend shooting party, and somebody dies. And as the police go about solving the murder, all kinds of private intrigues occur, and this is really where the movie's focus is. Attention is paid to the mystery, and the solution is revealed at the end, but it feels kind of like an afterthought. One intriguing thing about this movie is how it's shot. The camera, for one thing, is always moving. There's never a shot where it's still. It's at least moving a little bit, and the effect is like we're one of the guests at this house, and we're wandering through from room to room, catching snippets of everything that's going on. Like two characters might be having an argument or something, and we'll come in on the middle of that, or we'll leave in the middle of that. We just get the idea that all these things are happening around this house, and we can only hear, you know, a little bit at a time as we move through the house. And not only are we a guest of the house, we're one of the servants. We're not one of the rich people, because we're always downstairs, or if we do go upstairs, it's always when a servant is present. It's a neat effect there. But, you know, the movie's about behavior, about life at this time, and different, when people observe different stations in life, and it works. You really come away with a better understanding of what's different about these lifestyles.
Can we go a single top six list without including both Robert Altman and the Coen brothers? I don't think so. Anyway, my number two film is The Big Sleep from 1946 by director Howard Hawks, based on the Raymond Chandler novel. Like I said earlier, The Big Lebowski is a sort of half-hearted parody of The Big Sleep, but The Big Sleep is about Humphrey Bogart as Detective Philip Marlowe as he searches for this missing driver and gets tangled up with a chauffeur who's killed, and his bodies start piling up. He sort of tries to uncover what's going on and all, but the movie kind of loses track of who's killed whom and why. There is very famously an anecdote. The director, Howard Hawks, supposedly couldn't figure out who killed this chauffeur character and allegedly wired Raymond Chandler and asked who did it, and Chandler's response was, "How the hell should I know?" Because, of course, in the novel, it's not clear at all either. And really what the movie ends up becoming about is a romance between the Bogart character and Lauren Bacall. It was filmed just shortly after To Have and Have Not was a huge hit with Bogart and Bacall, and so the studio added in a bunch of more romantic scenes between the two of them, actually to the movie's betterment. It's a better film with those scenes in them, but it's much, much less of a focused mystery. By the end of the movie, we do, I guess, figure out who's killed whom, except for the chauffeur, but I think we kind of stop caring.
Yeah, I think it's a little more mystery-centered than you do, but definitely there is that loose end that's a pretty important one, and the movie does focus on the relationship between the two main characters. Well, my number two, as I mentioned up before, was Blow Up, and I just want to add something. You know, mysteries tend to be all about the answers to the questions. You pose them questions, and by the end, you get the answers. I think that Blow Up is actually about the questions, and you start out not knowing what the questions are, and by the end, you know what they are. If you think about it a little bit, and if you figure out the questions, you don't need the answer. It's like, Hitchhiker's Guide, the meaning of life and universe and everything, or whatever, 42, that doesn't tell you anything. But if you had the question, then you'd have something.
I think it's the first time I've ever heard Antonioni compared to Douglas Adams.
Well, it's the first time for everything. But yeah, it's an interesting movie about perception versus reality, and definitely a very memorable ending that sort of drives that point home.
So my top pick is probably my favorite thriller, and that's Rear Window, the classic 1954 film by Alfred Hitchcock, in which Jimmy Stewart plays, once again, here we go, another photographer, who has a broken leg, stuck in his apartment in a wheelchair, begins spying on his neighbors, and sees one of them maybe commits a murder, maybe doesn't. And though the film does end up resolving this, and the thrust of the story is really, did he do it or did he not? In a way, the ending could have gone either way. It doesn't really matter. And I think it's interesting because so many of Hitchcock's endings have been spoiled for us by popular culture. By the time you're old enough to appreciate Hitchcock, you already know how half of them have ended just because they've been parodied so much. But Rear Window parodies, I think most of them either go either way, whether or not the character did it or not. I don't think you necessarily, if you haven't seen the movie, you may not know exactly how it ends going into it, which is interesting because it's really more about voyeurism and how watching people can do weird things to us, how it's probably not all that healthy. And of course, this is the thing that Hitchcock is always interested in, the idea of voyeurism. And it's sort of perhaps doubly interesting because Hitchcock was a movie maker, which means he brings us stories about people that we can observe and be voyeurs in. And this is a film that explicitly calls attention to that idea.
That's a really neat pick. I hadn't really thought of Rear Window as fitting in this category, but clearly it does, and it's one of my favorite movies of all time, definitely. My number one is 12 Angry Men from 1957, directed by Sidney Lumet. It was his first movie. The setup is pretty well known. The movie opens with 12 jurors adjourning to deliberate the case, and 11 of the jurors think he's guilty, and one thinks he's innocent. And because of that, one troublesome juror, played by Henry Fonda, they get to talking about the case and discover things about it in the process. But the point of the movie isn't whether or not the guy committed the crime. It has more to do with the pursuit of legal justice rather than moral justice. And it's about these jurors and their perspectives and why they make the judgments they make. This is a real classic that holds up as well today, I think, as 50 years ago. If you haven't seen this one, I definitely urge you to seek it out. Even amongst people who may not be into a lot of classic movies, this is a real favorite.
Yeah, you know how you were kicking yourself about Clue? I'm not kicking myself about 12 Angry Men. Yeah, it's obvious. What a great pick. I pretty much agree with everything you said. Let's go ahead and wrap it up. My top six mysteries, where the mystery itself doesn't really matter. Number six, Clue from 1985. Number five, the stoner comedy Big Lebowski from 1998. Number four, The Conversation, Francis Ford Coppola's 1974 movie about sound. Number three, Blow Up by Michelangelo Antonioni. Number two, The Big Sleep, Howard Hawks' film from 1946. And my number one mystery where the mystery doesn't matter, Rear Window in 1954 by Alfred Hitchcock.
And my number six is Murder by Death from 1976. Number five, A Shot in the Dark from 1964. Number four, La Ventura from 1960. Number three, Gosford Park, the obligatory Robert Altman pick in 2001. Number two, Blow Up in 1966. And number one, 12 Angry Men from 1957.
In the last entry in our Film Buffs Dictionary, we talked about tracking shots. Those are shots where the camera moves along a track. I want to talk about a couple other camera movements, and so let's talk about today crane shots and handheld shots. These are both different ways of moving the camera, and they both draw a lot of attention to themselves, but they're different from tracking shots because they give you more flexibility and more movement, even than, say, a Steadicam shot might. The first is a crane, and basically you put the camera on a platform, which you attach it basically to a large crane, so you can move both horizontally, because you can push the crane around, and you can also move vertically. You can move up and down and swoop all over the place. It's really interesting, because you can get really high up, and so a lot of shots where you see the camera looking down on people are crane shots, because obviously it's hard to get the camera up high. And you can even do cool things where you can attach the camera to a dolly and put it on the platform so you can swoop all around and then in one single unbroken shot also put the camera back down on the ground and start moving following actors as they walk around. This is commonly used. A lot of what we think of the most impressive tracking shots are really things that combine crane and dolly shots. And so there's a lot of famous crane shots. The opening of Touch of Evil, which we've talked about quite a bit, that's a long crane shot as you follow the cars along this Mexican border town. There's a very, very famous crane shot in High Noon, the Western film, where you see the hero who has been basically abandoned by all the town, and we come out over this long empty street right up to the hero, and we see him, you know, just standing there by himself, and we get a feel of how empty everything is. And it's usually also a lot of other Westerns. Sergio Leone in his movies did a lot too. And a fun thing is, if you've ever seen the film The Stuntman, which is actually a great movie from the 1970s, it's about the making of a movie, and the director, played by Peter O'Toole, is constantly on a crane swooping around, and so, you know, two characters will be talking, and the director, who's just having fun with his crane, will swoop in and say something and swoop out. It's kind of interesting. You want to see what the crane looks like. That's a good movie to check out. The other interesting way of moving the camera around is handheld. And this is basically where a camera operator is holding the camera. And so you don't get any sort of smoothness because, you know, you can't hold the camera straight. And it's very difficult to hold. And if you're taking a film camera, it's very difficult to hold the camera straight for any period of time. So you see a lot of shakiness. And it's used to give us a sense of immediacy, of being there. Documentary films, for instance, are filmed usually with handheld cameras because, of course, you can't lay out tracks because you don't know exactly where people are going to move. You can't use steady cams because you might have to go all over the place inside buildings and upstairs and stuff, so it's not going to be that easy. So we've all seen documentaries. We've seen Cops, perhaps. The television show is most famous. You think of the cameraman always running around. We hear his breath as the camera shakes up and down. And so that's translated a lot lately, especially into movies, to give us a sense that we're watching not a film, but almost a documentary. War movies especially use this now, ever since Saving Private Ryan in 1998. We're constantly seeing, every time you see a battle in a war movie these days, it seems like it's a handheld shot. Lots of shakiness and jitteriness. It gives us a sense of disorientation. It feels like you're actually in the middle of combat. And it's particularly good at confusing us and making us feel disjointed. But some other directors like to use a lot of handheld work, even in more straight dramatic films. Probably Michael Mann, the director of movies such as The Insider, Heat, and Collateral, really uses it a lot. And he doesn't use it necessarily so much for battle scenes, even though he does shoot some great action moments. But he likes to get sort of that more documentary feel, where we feel like we're watching characters who are actually there living and breathing and not just filmed moments. So we get the sense that, yeah, we're there and this is actually happening.
One of my favorite handheld shots is in The Man Who Knew Too Much, the remake that Alfred Hitchcock made to his own film. But there's a scene where Jimmy Stewart is walking down the sidewalk, and on the soundtrack you only hear his footsteps, and the handheld shot gives his perspective as he's walking down the sidewalk. And, you know, it's hard to describe just in words the effect of it, but in context it creates this real sense of foreboding that something, he's going to be discovering something wrong, but we're not really sure what necessarily. But I think today, handheld shots are just not understood at all, especially on television. They're overused and exaggerated, so it's real shaky. I mean, you don't draw somebody into your story by making them seasick.
Right.
And plus, like any of these techniques practically, only really work in contrast. If you have constant tracking shots everywhere, they're not impressive anymore unless you have isolated tracking shots and everything else is something different. So if you're always using handhelds, you lose the effect of it. But definitely, you can use these to great effect. So we're at the end of the episode, and it's time to answer the trivia question for this week, which was to identify the writer and director of the thriller Finder's Fee, starring James Earl Jones and a bunch of other people. And it was a multiple choice question to make it a little easier. We named four different hosts of reality shows on television. One of these guys actually made a really good movie. So take a guess as to who that is, Stephen.
I'm just going to go for the only one I actually know and guess Joe Rogan.
Joe Rogan. Well, you'd be incorrect. The answer is Jeff Probst, who is the host of Survivor. It came out a year after Survivor did, but the financing was secured for it, and the green light came right around the same time as he was hired to do the show, so nobody knew who he was. Anyway, not only is this a good movie, but also has an absolutely fantastic production commentary track, one of the best I've ever heard. It contains a lot of information about how they got the movie made and what the processes of securing financing and casting and shooting were all like, what got them in the door at production companies when nobody knew who these guys were. Like a lot of small films from unknown directors, it's a minor miracle that it ever got made, even apart from such disasters as, you know, for example, the set burnt down entirely the night before the first day of shooting.
Yeah.
After everybody put it all together. And that
might be a problem.
Yeah, and, you know, on a big budget movie, you say, oh, well, crud, no, I'll spend a little bit more money and I'll make it, but it can really sink a small movie like this. So watch a movie and definitely listen to the commentary.
So the show is over for this week, but what's not over are new posts at our website. They happen all the time, and the address, and just in case you've forgotten it, is allmovietalk.com. We want you to just head on over there and participate in the great discussion about movies.
And of course, check out the Rinkworks website as well. There's a bunch of movie-related stuff there. Next week, next Tuesday, on the 16th of January, we'll have another episode talking about computers and computers in movies and computers making movies and things like that. But we'll also squeeze in a couple other segments, such as continuing our series about sound in the movies. So check us out then.
Cut. Action. Cut. Action. Cut. Action. Cut. Action. Cut. Action. Cut. Oh, you look at those camera guys go.